Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. And Jim, we would be totally remiss if at least two of our martinis today did not come from an absolutely fascinating and relatively brief press conference the president held defending a tax cut compromise that he seems to loathe himself for. A lot of folks thinking that this is basically the most significant meltdown in real time since Howard Dean following the Iowa caucuses, only without actually raising his voice. The president calling the Republicans hostage takers, the extension of tax cuts for the rich completely unacceptable, yet he's going along with it. And then, of course, the issue of the Democrats who are critical of him, which presents our good martini of the day, the president going after his own party, essentially saying this is the same thing as the debate over the public option. The purists in the party wanted that and don't consider what did pass to be acceptable without the public option, and the president was having none of it.
Now, if that's the standard by which we are measuring success or core principles, then let's face it, we will never get anything done. People will have the satisfaction of having a purist position and no victories for the American people. And we will be able to feel good about ourselves and sanctimonious about how pure our intentions are and how tough we are.
How well do you think that line is going to rally the current Democratic majorities to actually pass this thing in the lame duck session?
Fall in behind me, sanctimonious jerks! You know, I am sure that it's going to be... many, many liberals at this moment are probably thinking, I can't believe the president is calling me sanctimonious in such a sanctimonious fashion. you know, you could argue this is pot to kettle, you're black, whatever metaphor you want to use there. One thing that's fascinating about this was there are quite a few times Obama will speak and I will not feel like I'm not watching the same speech as everybody else's. I remember the 2008 convention speech and the big with the Greek columns and the address in the Denver Stadium. I thought it was actually a pretty bad one. And many other folks said it was the greatest speech since the last speech Obama had given because all of them are super duper fantastic and off the scale. But in this one, it was kind of reassuring to see across the political spectrum, left, right, and center, almost everybody was watching had the attitude of, oh my goodness, I can't believe what I'm watching here. And you saw members of the press corps observing. One of the things that jumped out at me was how often Obama was contradicting himself. And I think it's because his thinking on this is very muddied. He hates this deal, but he needs to persuade Democrats to vote for it. But he also needs to persuade them that he hasn't sold them out. So this is a terrible deal, and it's necessary and must be passed. But he hates it. But we must pass it. But he hates it, you know, and it's just kind of this strange circular thinking that each time he makes one point, he suddenly reverts back to this other completely contradictory thing that he wants to emphasize. And, you know, he kept insisting to the press that he doesn't really care about what they say or what they write, but he kept quoting him back to him. He complained that the South Korean trade deal got too many headlines when it wasn't going, when the negotiations weren't going well, but too few headlines when they were. A president ombudsman, Obama, apparently. It was really kind of bizarre to see such a prickly, short-tempered, ill-tempered, cranky, irritable president lashing out left, right, and center at, you know, the right for being hostage takers and the left for being sanctimonious. I guess, like, you know, in between those two, if you're not a hostage taker, you're a sanctimonious, or you're the president who is this, you know, modern Socrates embodiment of wisdom for all of us.
Exactly. And ideology never factors into his position on what ought to be done. But you mentioned before that he kind of took a shot at the journalists and actually the New York Times editorial page in particular, which might be the first time that's ever happened in public from a Democratic president, unless they didn't think that the Times was going far left enough. But here's what the president had to say, again, about this ideological purity. But this time, this might be the bad martini. Let's take a listen.
This is a big, diverse country. Not everybody agrees with us. I know that shocks people. You know, the New York Times editorial page does not permeate across all of America.
Now, it sounds like the same rant, and it pretty much is, but it seems like that's the first time President Obama has really understood, perhaps, at least for the most part, what happened last month. Before, he talked about how people want everybody to work together and the economy is the problem, but he actually understands now that the whole world doesn't necessarily agree with him just because he hath spaken it.
Greg, notice he said that like 2 or 3 minutes after insisting the polls were on his side
right.
on this issue. My theme of internal contradictions there continues. You're right, and this is a very different tact than we've heard from this president before. In some eyes, it's an acknowledgement of reality. I think it's kind of fascinating that this acknowledgement of reality comes 2 years into his presidency. I mean, you know, where was this? We can't do just what the New York Times editorial page wants during the Obamacare debate or during some of these cabinet appointments or during, you know, the stimulus or any one of the other major decisions made by this administration. It sounds like a concession, but I think it's only in the tone of, darn you liberals, don't you understand I'm the best thing that ever happened to you? It really is in this sense of – there's almost this indignation in his voice. And you notice that point where he said, you know, this is a big, diverse country. We're not – you know, he says something, you know, that maybe that this is news to some people. Sarcasm really doesn't roll very well off a president's tongue. And I don't mean just this president. I mean when we think of the Oval Office, we think of the images of Lincoln during the Civil War, of FDR during World War II, going up through – Kennedy, Nixon, Reagan, all the, you know, these grand important decisions, sarcasm doesn't come to mind. And I think it just kind of comes across as small and just basically unpresidential. Now, obviously, in the long history of presidential statements and decisions, this is probably fairly small potatoes. But I think it just comes across as condescending and lecturing and, hey, I don't know if you notice this, but not everybody agrees with us, yeah. You sanctimonious liberals.
Exactly. That's the first time I think he may have realized it, and partially because obviously the political reality has changed and he can't just ignore what the rest of the country thinks because he doesn't have the numbers in Congress anymore, at least won't soon. And obviously he got a little bit of a comeuppance and more than a little bit on Election Day. And we'll see if that actually translates into the new Congress or whether the class warfare slings and arrows will just be out there even more than ever. But as we head into the new Congress, we also head into, Jim, the third martini, which is the 2012 presidential campaign. And there are folks out there who believe that the perfect strategy for Obama to win re-election is to follow the example of Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. Deval Patrick isn't exactly the world's most popular person, and he basically won because he had two challengers this year. So is that the key to victory?
Yeah, this comes from an article in the New Republic, heavily quoting unnamed White House sources, but it's a good reason to think this is genuinely the kinds of conversations they're having inside the White House right now. Very plausible that David Axelrod, who has both Barack Obama and Deval Patrick as clients, might think that what worked for one could work for the other. At one point, Deval Patrick's reelection chances looked pretty darn small. He was very unpopular. People in Massachusetts were very down on him. The only thing that really changed is that he managed to turn 48% into a winning percentage in Election Day 2010. It's because he had both Republican Charlie Baker and an independent bid from Tim Cahill, who was a Democrat turned independent, splitting the anti-incumbent vote. Is there possible to be a third party bid in 2012 that would split the anti-incumbent vote against Obama? It could. I don't think that's come to the fore yet. I know Bloomberg's giving a big speech today. But there are several larger points among them. Massachusetts is not America. I mean, to be a Democrat and lose the Senate race in Massachusetts, we've learned you need to trash Red Sox pitchers. That's right. That's how, you know, you need to have that kind of a colossal screw up before the voters will say, okay, it's time to really look seriously at other options here. So there's that factor. There's the factor that I think the Massachusetts economy, it's been ahead of the national economy in terms of recovery and in terms of reducing unemployment. So I don't know if that necessarily will apply to the nation as a whole come 2012. And just kind of this general sense that Obama's, you know, in a deeper hole, I think, because I don't know if Deval Patrick was elected as the embodiment of hope and change, the man who's going to save the state from a true crisis, or whether he was elected because he was a Democrat. When Patrick won back in 2006, he won, I believe, 55% of the vote to about 35 or something, you know, a really large margin.
Right.
Obama didn't win by that large a margin in 2008, and he really doesn't have that much space to lose. You look at his approval rating these days, it's consistently – he's underwater quite a bit. He's in the high 40s. If the opposition is unified, that doesn't translate to a winning percentage in 2012.
Yeah, 48% is the goal for success in 2 years. Then Republicans have reason to smile, and heck, maybe this should have been the good martini, but we had a pretty darn good martini today anyway.
It fits for the crazy one since it seems like a crazy strategy. And look, you know, there is something of a silver lining for this, Greg. If Obama does apply this strategy, I do think he has a really good chance of being elected governor of Massachusetts.
That's the silver lining for him next time. Jim, we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Join us tomorrow for the next 3 Martini Lunch.